Molly, holy cow. I was just listening to you, and I'm like, y'all don't need to hear from me. Because we just saw and felt the power of feminine energy. And it's like, I don't know. I'm just, thank you. That was amazing. And maybe that's part of the reason I want to sit down is because I will be very honest with you. I kind of struggled in putting together my message. Of all the talks I've given, this one feels like it's been the most difficult birth. And if I were to carry on with that birth metaphor, which we learned last week from Sarah Kornfield, is part of the way that women tend to frame their rhetoric, I'd say that this birth is a preemie. It's not ready for the world, but it had a due date, so here it is. And somebody said in pre-talk, she'll start with a joke. And I was like, oh, I got her to do that. So there you go. There's the joke. But I always love Wayne's meditations. And I'm going to quote him right now just to harken back to one of the most famous ones that will probably live on in C3 infamy. What the hell? Here we are in Women's History Month. And women and their needs and contributions are being erased. Just Friday, I read news reports that in-depth information about veterans who were people of color and women were being scrubbed from the Arlington Memorial National Cemetery website. And why? Because they had a whiff of that horrible thing called diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's just one of many unfortunate examples of how women and people of color and LGBTQ+ people are essentially being canceled and told that our bodies aren't ours to control, our voices don't count if we're not falling in line, and our contributions that help our communities thrive don't matter. And I need to like raise this up. Oops, so much for that. I don't know if somebody can, quickly assist me, sorry. I'm like, otherwise I'm just gonna be like looking down too much. Thank you. All right. Woohoo! To the rescue. There, I was a damsel in distress, and they just rescued me, so I'm really grateful. We're going to talk about that. And so much for the anger that I was feeling a moment ago, because I want to say, what's left? What does count? Who does count? I'm going to risk being seen as an angry feminist when I say that straight white men. And no offense against straight white men, but what the hell? What do straight white men who are leading this government, what do their efforts to push women into the shadows get wrong? They negate the presence, the power, and the necessity of feminine energy. What they get wrong is thinking that feminine energy can be controlled. They forget that they have feminine energy within them, whether they like it or not. They mock men who have a healthy relationship with their feminine energy and do whatever they can to suppress their own. They fear it. And they think just because we talk about feminine energy that we're anti-masculine. And those of us who are feminists, we know that that is couldn't be further from the truth. They're working against the feminine archetype that is in all of us. They're resisting integration and therefore missing out on all of the gifts that their higher power has given them. They're not claiming their full inheritance. There's so much that could be dissected about how and why men and even some women shortchange themselves when it comes to acknowledging and embracing all parts of themselves. But I'm not a scholarly academic like Sarah Kornfield or a Mesa carrier like Ruth Swald. Both of them shared very insightful messages with us earlier this month. And I thought about it and I thought, well, the only thing that we really have in common is that each of us, Sarah, Ruth, Beth, if you think about it, biblical roots for our first names. So that's what we share. But really what I am is just like the average woman who's completely lost her words and is trying to relocate them and find a way through all this mess. And I don't know how I did it, but somehow I came up with about 3,000 words. So I did find some, and I'll try to make the most of them. And maybe that describes you too, that maybe you have lost your words. Maybe you used to know what to say and how to say it, but you're flooded with emotion. Or maybe you're numb and you've lost that capacity to articulate really clearly how you feel. And that's why I want to focus for the next few minutes, for the next, 2,800 words, on getting back in touch with the truth about feminine energy and archetypes. I'm thinking maybe that will help me and help us to find our words and our voice again. According to most of the resources that I found, there are 7 primary female archetypes. And they're not the archetypes as Jung described them. I think there are 4, like ego, self, anima, and animus. But we think of archetype figures that are dominant in Western society. The maiden, the mother, the huntress, the lover, the queen, the sage, and the mystic. So those are the 7 primary. And we think of archetypes, we usually think of Carl Jung. And while he didn't create the concept, he did apply it to depth psychology and bring it to a wider audience. And there are also, of course, masculine archetypes, the 4 primary ones being king, warrior, magician, and lover. I want to acknowledge those. We will come back to those in just a little bit, but our main focus, of course, is on those feminine figures and how they show up in all of us. Now, I'm not the academic. I'm working from my own experience, what I've extrapolated, what I've learned here at C3 over the years. And what came up for me is it seems like the core of society tends to limit women to just a few of those 7 archetypes, primarily focusing on the maiden, the mother, and the lover. The maiden embodies curiosity and innocence and vulnerability, a certain naivete about how the world works, and as an extension about the consequences of the choices that they make. If someone has immature maiden energy, then this can be someone of any gender. They will give over their power to someone else and be compliant and passive. Think damsel in distress. They can lose their identity in deference to their partner or other dominant elements, such as their career or children. At its healthiest and most mature, a person who's in touch with their maiden energy will be playful and creative, open to new ideas and influences while still maintaining their sense of self. When it comes to the mother, we intuitively know what that archetype is like, since we all have a mother and we've experienced her energy. I'd speculate that this is the most dominant archetype associated with women in our culture, as it's on a baseline level, what biologically differentiates us from men. It's the most obvious, and in some people's estimation, the most prized. Of course, it's associated with physically, literally bringing life into the world and nurturing it into adulthood. But archetypes are psychological and spiritual patterns, not literal behaviors or choices that we consciously make. So the mother archetype shows up in all of us to some degree, whether we have children or not, whether we're female or not. The broader view of the mother energy is that it places a high value on showing love and support to others. It manifests as compassion, empathy, and a bond so strong that it will go to great lengths to protect what it cares about. When that energy overfunctions, the mother in us can become clingy and codependent, causing us to lose our sense of identity and agency. And that brings us to the lover, which represents sensuality and intimacy. And I would guess is probably the next most prominent energy generally associated with women after mother. It might also be the most powerful when you consider how many cultures and religions go to great lengths to suppress lover energy through rules about clothing and grooming and acceptable, permissible relationships. And words that came up as I read about this energy were magnetism, radiance, abundance, impulsive, and emotionally driven. I think there was a picture of Molly next to it. I don't know about impulsive. I don't know. If anybody wants to argue with me, you can, but... The darker side, and I'm sure that this is not true for you. The darker side of the lover energy is allowing its pursuit of pleasure to become unhealthy, showing up as addiction or overindulgence. The desire for validation might lead to a lack of commitment as it grows bored of established relationships and seeks that thrill of a new source to passionately tell it that it's loved and cherished. Not you? Right, I thought so. I'm totally putting you on the spot, I'm sorry. The way that I've described these archetype figures is superficial, but sufficient for our consideration today. And describing and reflecting on them and their dominance enables us to see more clearly where the gaps are in our understanding of the totality of feminine energy. That totality includes figures that are sometimes suppressed, the ones I named before, the huntress, the queen, the sage, the mystic. And I'll bring us back to those in just a minute. And when I titled this talk, sort of as I alluded in the beginning, What We Get Wrong About Feminine Energy, I really wasn't sure where I was going with the idea. I liked the title. And by we, I had to think about this, I mean society at large, and maybe men in particular. And I don't mean all men. I'm talking about the men, and to be clear, some women, who seem determined to cast in stone the patriarchal structure that affirms their power or gives them a sense of security. And yes, there are individuals that seem fully integrated and don't experience a lot of tension with their feminine side. We have many of them in this room. That's one of the things I love about this community. We see it demonstrated all the time. I feel fortunate to be married to one. I just feel on a gut level that our collective relationship to feminine energy is dysfunctional. And that's not exactly a newsflash. But I believe it's good to remind ourselves that when society tries to cancel something, it's usually because it can't handle its complexity or its power. It wants to dumb it down to its simplest form and reduce it to good or bad, right or wrong. Whether that's casting a person as completely terrible for one bad choice, or because that person perceives a threat to their identity, or they can't or won't comprehend a person or a situation. And right now, women are among those that are being canceled unless they conform to the simplest definition of what it means to be a woman. What we can't seem to get right, and this came up in pre-talk, is that to be fully human means to embrace the feminine and masculine archetype figures that live in all of us. For my part, and this was really the first time that I've been able to articulate this, I don't strive to be the most womanly woman I can be, or to put it another way, to be the womaniest woman that I can woman. That's a callback. Instead, I strive to be the most fully human, the most fully realized human that only I can be, the Bethiest Beth. And encompass more than those three energies, to transcend and include. I want to be able to express my huntress, my queen, my sage, and my mystic. I want to feel whole, and I will feel whole when I am in healthy relationship with my masculine energies of king, warrior, magician, and lover. It's really the most important work that any of us can do. As Jung said, the privilege of a lifetime is to become who you truly are. And when we are truly who we are, not who we think we should be, we are making our most authentic contribution and living in highest alignment to our purpose. I've been thinking a lot over the past few weeks about what it means to have a healthy balance of energies and wondering if there was a name for it. For example, when you think about introvert and extrovert energy, what's in the middle? What's the term for that? Does anybody? Ambivert, right? So we got this, you know, well-balanced mixture of the two. And to my mind, while we might lead with one or the other, the goal is to have that integration. And so I wondered, is there a psychological equivalent to masculine and feminine energy? And what I found has become my new favorite word. And let's see if I say it right the first time. Syzygy. Syzygy. So syzygy is an astrological term that's defined as the nearly straight line configuration of three celestial bodies, such as the sun, the moon, and the earth during a solar or lunar eclipse, in a gravitational system. Did anybody get up at like 3 a.m. and see? I did, yeah, it was super cool, right? So we experienced that syzygy just this week. Now, Carl Jung adapted this term to describe deep psychological relationships. It's described this way by the Psychology Lexicon. In psychology, the term syzygy refers to a state of balance or union between opposing forces or elements. In Jungian psychology, syzygy refers to the integration of the anima, which is the feminine aspect of the male psyche, and the animus, which is the masculine aspect of the female psyche. It refers to that integration into the common or the conscious self. This integration is seen as necessary for achieving wholeness and balance in the psyche. What would happen if we all set syzygy as an intention? Not to stumble into it or miss it entirely because we're too busy or too tired or too distracted, but to take time to get to know and honor the diversity of energies that live within us, and then feel free to express them. I'm really glad that Brad emailed a summary of Ruth's talk a few weeks ago. And if anybody's not on the email list, it's very valuable to have because it reminded me of a key piece of advice and a question that Ruth asked. She said, embrace your own inner feminine wisdom and strength. And then she asks, in what ways do you unconsciously diminish your own strength to make others more comfortable? Feminine wisdom and strength comes from each of the archetype figures, but we're not often rewarded for the huntress, the queen, the sage, and the mystic. The huntress is too driven and fierce. The queen is too domineering and powerful. The sage is too preachy and independent. The mystic is too woo-woo and introverted. So we consciously and unconsciously diminish those energies so that we can be acceptable, to make others more comfortable. If women demonstrate those energies, even in a healthy manner, we risk, not always, but we risk being deemed aggressive, bitchy, selfish, or flaky. If I'd been working on this talk a year or two ago, I think I would have had a different spin. What I've shared would still be true, but I wouldn't have felt that feminine energy was as endangered as it is right now. We have men in power over-functioning in the shadow side of the king archetype, which is the tyrant. The tyrant is the antithesis of healthy feminine energy. When it's in the driver's seat, it gives other people permission to unleash their inner tyrant, and it upsets any balance that might have existed. And because of all of the upheaval, we find ourselves in a space where people are thinking in a dualistic manner. We've fallen into either-or thinking. Things are black and white, or black or white, good or bad, and so on. There's a relief, actually, that comes from dualistic thinking. It's a shortcut. It's easy. We don't have to spend precious brain power trying to figure out nuances or gray areas because we'd rather have quick answers and just get on with life. If we're going to make it through the squeeze that Ruth described a couple weeks ago, that transition from the age of duality into the age of unity, we need to find a non-dualistic way of seeing ourselves and others. This doesn't dismiss the dominant energies that we have because of our gender, but we need to find that both and mindset. It's imperative that we do the hard work of integration if we're going to move from duality to unity in one piece. So what do too many people get wrong about feminine energy? We oversimplify it. And we think that it's only for and about women. We try to cover it up so that we can be acceptable to others. And here's a point that I think is really interesting that came up last week when Sarah was here, and I think it came up in pre-talk. We, and that includes women, men, non-binary, queer, everyone, have to reflect deeply on how we respond the way we do to women leaders. Someone in pre-talk asked, what can we do to get female politicians that win elections? What can they do to make people like them or think that they're electable? And Sarah's response was nothing. There's nothing women can do because objectively speaking, we've had incredibly strong female politicians and leaders. In 2016 and 2024, we had two of the most qualified people in history run for president. They were smart, strong, strategic, they could be compassionate, hardworking, and they had devoted their lives, their entire lives, to service.
They had their flaws, but compared to the other person in the race, they were practically saints. And yet, we didn't elect them. Sarah's answer was that there wasn't something wrong with them. There was something wrong with us, with the culture. If we want more women politicians and leaders, the culture needs to change, not them. I found that very discouraging, even as I knew it to be true. Remember what I said in the beginning about losing my words. I'm still mostly at a loss. I don't know how to respond to something like that, where it's the culture and not them. But I have found a few of my words while gathering thoughts for this talk. So let's close with the reading in your bulletin as a way to tie this all together. What are little boys made of? What are little boys made of? Snips, snails, and puppy dogs' tails. That's what little boys are made of. What are little girls made of? What are little girls made of? Sugar and spice and everything nice. That's what little girls are made of. That's the narrative we've been working with for centuries. The boy as the mischievous imp and the girl as the demure sweetheart. Stereotypical, limiting, simplistic. But here's my ray of sunshine in all of this. When I looked up the source of that rhyme, I came across a post on an LGBT Reddit thread. The poster was writing about their dislike of the dualistic gender language and framing that pervades culture and asked, if girls are made of sugar and spice and everything nice, and boys are made of snips, snails, and puppy dogs' tails, then what are non-binary people made of? Good question. There were 426 answers. Fortunately, Reddit sifts to the top whatever the top answer is, and it was glitter, fire, and anything that you could desire. Right? And that answer makes me so happy. And it somehow fits with Syzygy. It transcends and includes the magical and the practical and the mother and the warrior. It's expansive and honors the range of energies that we all carry within us, that the collective unconscious has been gathering from our ancestors. So I'll leave you with a few questions. In what ways do you already honor the feminine energy within you and that archetype? Where could you turn up the volume on your feminine energy? Where could you model that energy for others? And I think that's part of the answer to how culture changes. What work do we need to do to become more integrated? The more models and the more work we do that we do around Syzygy, those people who are willing to lean into and talk about the complexity of the human condition, the more we'll inch our way towards the culture shift that's needed. We cannot continue on the path we're on. As Lincoln said in 1858, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And Jesus said centuries before that, any kingdom divided against itself will be ruined, and a house divided against itself will fall. What I love about C3, we're committed to being a house united through our value of well-being. We promote wholeness and wellness of mind, body, and spirit, recognizing our self-responsibility, our interrelatedness, and our interdependence. I hope you'll join me in using Wayne's word of praying. I hope you'll join me in praying that we recognize our glitter, our fire, and anything that you desire. Thank you.